When he returned to the Oval Office, Donald Trump signed 143 executive orders in his first 100 days, which easily broke the old record. In case you're wondering, that was set by FDR back in 1933-99. You might believe now that an executive order has a single focus with a single purpose. Not always the case. Several of Trump's executive orders have made things, let's call them, challenging for college universities, as well as uncomfortable for parts of their campus populations. My next guest is here to discuss how this is all being responded to. He is Vice President of Legal Affairs with the Landmark Legal Foundation, Mike O'Neill. Thanks for being here today, Mike.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you.
LandmarkLegal.org. Learn more about a lot of the things that might be confusing to you, but they take the legalese and the political jargon and put it down to really stuff you can understand and realize the importance of it. We are talking about American Association of University Professors v. Trump, and this is a response by a conglomeration of education organizations in response to the threatening of research funding, federal funding, if the college universities, primarily in California, do not follow Trump administration policy edicts, I guess we'll say. I was going to say preferences, regarding DEI and transgender. Talk about the background of this case and the mechanics of it as far as how this is bleeding over into other areas versus just, like I said back in the intro, an executive order usually is a single bullet point hitting the bullseye target.
Right. In a lot of these, in a lot of these cases, what these entailed were letters. It's funny, we classify them obviously as executive orders because they're an executive action. But if you read a lot of these executive orders, essentially what you're saying is these are reminding organizations or entities that receive federal fundings, in this case, you know, colleges and universities who are large recipients of grants from the federal government, that they have to comply with the law. In other words, they cannot discriminate on the basis of race, sex, or gender, etc. And so these actions are, these executive actions, in a lot of ways are countenanced and are posited in the terms of, hey, University of California system, this is to remind you that you cannot discriminate on the basis of race, sex, or gender. The Constitution and the Civil Rights Act prohibit this. If you decide you're going to do this, you are risking federal funding of your programs. And so what happened was, and again, in this unceasing lawfare environment that we're seeing right now, that triggered a lot of these lawsuits by these organizations, particularly these well-funded amalgamations of these organizations like that you talked about, and initiated a lawsuit. They ran to court and they say, look, we're being discriminated against. Even though essentially what's happened is there hasn't been an action. These are almost kind of a pre-enforcement. They're saying they are, the plaintiffs in these cases are saying, look, you are telling us something we can't do. You're positing, you're conditioning federal grants on something that violates our First Amendment rights. We're going to sue you, even though an event hasn't occurred yet. So a lot of this has to do with guidance. And again, the fundamental truth is this, is these universities and these DEI programs have been discriminating on the basis of race. And then in trans cases, they're discriminating on the basis of gender here. If you are, again, in Students for Fair Admissions versus Harvard, this is a Supreme Court decision that came out last term. Remember what we said is that universities cannot discriminate on the basis, cannot use race to elevate, again, essentially affirmative action, cannot use race as dispositive for admissions to a university or college. So essentially what these are is these are termed in, I know they're classified as executive orders, but they're really, if you read down into it, these are guidance, and these are saying, look, do comply with the law or else, essentially.
Well, I think a point of confusion is that the funding that's being addressed threatened to be held back is specific research funding. It's not funding that goes to promotion of the social issues or the gender issues that seems to be the bone of contention here. That's where I think a lot of people have the question about, okay, if you don't want to fund what the executive orders or laws say as far as diversity or prejudice, that's all well and good, but why are you risking medical research funding, for example?
Right. Well, we know money is fungible in these cases, right? In these university systems, if you're going to get you might receive. And again, when you actually look at the legality of it, we have to look at the specific allocation, the specific designation of the grant. If it's a discretionary grant, there's a couple of things on. Yeah, let's break it down in a couple of ways. Number one, a lot of money is, let's make the first point. Money is fungible. If you're sending money to a university system, it can offset costs with other money. So any dollar I use to fund my research, I can use to offset, I can use those federal dollars for funding for research. I can use that offset for funding for administration or DEI programs. That's number one. Number two is that you have to look at the grants themselves. If this money is granted in the context of discretionary authority, in other words, the Department of Education who might have it, Department of Energy or whatever executive department has some discretionary authority within the language of the grant. In other words, part of it is saying that your university has to comply with the law in order to continue to receive this money, then you are jeopardizing your grant. So it's kind of when these organizations say, look, we're going to, the health and welfare is going to be adversely affected, a lot of that is kind of is essentially appealing to the emotional attributes, the emotional instincts of the populace to say, look, hey, this is the harm of this. Meanwhile, the institutions are probably, in a lot of cases, violating the terms of the grant and the fact that they're not complying with the law and the fact that they're discriminating on the basis of race or gender. And the administration has the authority, discretionary authority, to cease those grants when those conditions occur.
Dr. Mark O'Neill, who is Vice President of Legal Affairs with the Landmark Legal Foundation, landmarklegal.org, their website, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. Doing some background on all of this, I found a couple of universities, primarily with school athletics, who are, at least at this point, twisting around everything by saying to transgender athletes, you can practice, you can train, we're just not going to put you in the game. So it sounds like there are always ways around. I mean, rules are rules, and laws are laws, but there's always a way around both, aren't there?
Well, we'll see. I mean, interestingly enough, these state laws that are in place now, pertaining to transgender athletes in high school level sports, for example, or state laws that I think would also affect state universities are going to be challenged in front of the Supreme Court this term. So the legality of a West Virginia law that says only females who are born female can participate in women's athletics. That is a state law that's going to be, the constitutionality and the legality of that law is in front of the Supreme Court this term, and they're going to be weighing in on that, whether that's a constitutional, just and proper exercise of a state legislature. I think the court is poised to affirm those laws. In other words, say that the state has the authority to say females who are born female have to compete in female sports, and males who are born male have to compete in male sports, and that is not discriminatory, does not violate the 14th Amendment, and does not violate the Civil Rights Act. So when you're talking about practicing, that's one thing, but I think in terms of competition, you're going to see state laws come on board with this. You're also going to see market forces at play. I think, and there's certain jurisdictions, I've seen some stories where you're having a transgender individual playing on a female volleyball team, and that they can't find anybody to play against. That team, their opponents aren't playing them, aren't agreeing to play them in matches. So that's kind of market forces at play. And I think that's what you're going to see as well. So you're going to see some state laws. You're going to see the Supreme Court this term most likely affirming those state laws, and you're going to see market forces at play in these cases, which is probably how it should be.
When you mention the Supreme Court, that obviously takes us to legal precedent that can't be moved any way, shape, or form unless the Supreme Court goes against itself, which it has, you know, if you look at the history. But are there dangers in what could be a follow-up should what's being challenged now be set as precedent, and that next wave could be, well, less than justifiable, let's say?
Right. I see what you're saying. So what's interesting is, and there was a decision last term called U.S. versus Scrimeti. And if you recall that, this is the case out of Tennessee where the Tennessee legislature said that you can't use these puberty blockers drugs on minor children and the question was whether this was discriminatory for transgender individuals. And the court, particularly Amy Coney Barrett, weigh the issue, essentially exactly what you're talking about, is whether transgender individuals classify as a suspect class. And the court noted that in the flesh, she noted that in the last 50 years, there hasn't been any additions to suspect classes. And what do I mean by a suspect class? I mean, if you are part of a suspect class, in other words, if you're part of a, if there's a law that makes a classification based on race, for example, that is subject to the highest level of judicial scrutiny. In other words, the state has to have enormous justification for in order to justify its discrimination on the basis of race, separating individuals from race. Now, Amy Coney Barrett specifically said that transgender individuals do not reach that level. In other words, any law that a state passes that makes a determination on the basis of transgender versus non-transgender. In other words, in this case, saying we're going to prohibit the use of drugs for minor children for transgender issues, then that's subject to a more rational basis. So the court is more likely to affirm those state laws, if you can follow me. So my point is I don't think it's really a deviation. Ruling, in other words, what we're talking about in this athletics context, I don't really think it's a stretch for the Supreme Court. I think it's something that they've been doing for decades and decades, not extending this enhanced protections to new groups. Even handicapped groups don't necessarily, even individuals with handicaps don't necessarily qualify in that ultra strict scrutiny level of judicial review in these cases. So I don't think there's a lot of danger in this particular case regarding transgenders and athletics. I don't think there's a lot of dangers of creating new and dangerous precedent.
And I think how important is it to, as we wrap up here, to remember that the law has to be analytical, not emotional. I mean, there are communities that the laws are not going to be favorable toward for whatever reason, justifiable, fair, call it whatever you will. But the legal system always does provide at least a path to a recourse should that happen.
Certainly. And this is what you're seeing, again, in a lot of these contexts, is all of these actions are being the executive actions, for example, that we started to beginning of our discussion, we're talking about everybody's having their day in court, right? I mean, we're seeing that all of these interests that are obviously contra to Trump and the Trump administration's agenda are being played out in court, and the courts are seriously weighing the issues here, whether the executive is engaging in overreach. Let me give you just a quick example. We have the tariff case that's coming up in front of the Supreme Court in the we're talking in just a matter of weeks. The court's going, there is a legitimate chance, and again, I continue to say this in other venues, there's a legitimate chance that the Supreme Court's going to conclude that Donald Trump doesn't have the statutory authority to negotiate the tariffs as he's doing it. So the litigants in these cases and what you're intimating or what you're suggesting is clear that everybody's having their day in court and all of these issues are being weighed seriously and taken seriously. In a lot of ways, I think that lower courts are going beyond their authority, beyond their Article III authority, and exercising influence that they don't have. For example, a district court judge in Massachusetts saying that defunding Planned Parenthood constituted an unlawful bill of attainder. I think that's a perfect example of judicial overreach. But nonetheless, everybody's having their opportunity to challenge this in the way you're suggesting.
When you look at the law, for you listening, as we wrap up this segment with Mike, it's always important to remember the full picture, not just your focus or preference. And that's the only way that the justice system becomes fair and equal. Want to find out more about this issue, really anything to do with legalities, politics, when they combine, when they collide, and to make sense of it all, that's why the Landmark Legal Foundation is around landmarklegal.org. Here's our VP of Legal Affairs, Mike O'Neill. Mike, thanks so much for the education today. Appreciate it.
It's a pleasure. Take care. You have a great day.